During the last lecture, I showed you that once you have quantized properly an non-abelian gauge theory by gauge fixing, treating the gauge fixing Fadeyev Popov determinant as a functional integral over some additional ghost field, ghost and anti-ghost, which makes the job to write this functional determinant as just a part of a proper local quantum field theory, we get a quantum field theory with both the original gauge field, the ghost field, and an additional symmetry, which is a remnant of the gauge invariance, which now has been broken by gauge fixing. So we get a symmetry, which is now a rigid symmetry, a global symmetry. It acts in the same way on the fields at different points. So that's different from a gauge symmetry, where you are free to choose the transformation at every point in space-time. But it's a bit strange, because it's a symmetry that mixes the gauge field and the ghost field. So in fact, it's a simple example of a supersymmetric transformation, a supersymmetry, which mixes bosons and fermions. And in addition, it's a symmetry of the theory, namely the gauge fixed action is invariant under the action of this symmetry. And it has a property which is very important, which is that it is a nilpotent symmetry. Namely, if you apply twice the generator of the symmetry, you get zero. Okay. So, and that's in fact a key point in using this symmetry to properly quantize symmetry. So this was somehow abstract, that's important. That's abstract. Today, in the first part of this lecture, I hope to present you a simple example, which is how do you quantize the simplest of gauge theory, which is Maxwell's theory. There is no need of introducing ghosts, there is no abelianity, etc. But you can do that. And so what I'm doing is that doing BRST for Maxwell's theory. So the U1 gauge theory with no fermions, so it's a free theory. And I show you also what BRST means in the standard canonical quantization, where you think in terms of a Hilbert space of states, which is a Fock space, and you have creation and annihilation operator, and one particle states, two particle states, etc. So, and canonical quantization. So I hope this will make this mysterious BRST transformation a bit more understandable. Okay, so let's start with just Maxwell's theory. So Maxwell's theory has just an AMU field, which is the U1 gauge field. So it's a real field. There are no group components. F mu nu is just a standard d mu a nu minus d nu a mu. That's the field strength. And you can gauge fix it. Gauge fixing. You have to gauge fix the theory in order to treat it properly. And the simplest way is to use this Lorentz-Landau gauge. D mu a mu equals zero, but then to use this trick that I presented by Feynman, so that to replace it by it's in fact the chi gauge. So you had d mu a mu squared term in the functional integral, and in particular for chi, for the particular choice of chi equal one, the action becomes, for U1 field, becomes very simple. That's an exercise you can do. This is the integral over 4 time, and then you have just d mu a nu squared. So the d mu a mu squared term disappear for this particular choice of one. Of course, the result will be gauge invariant. Okay, so you get this. So this is the gauge fixed action in the chi equal one gauge. So it's a free field. But now, of course, you fix the gauge. So in the functional integral, there is a Fadeyev Popov determinant. But this Fadeyev Popov determinant is completely independent of A mu. And we have seen in discussing the Fadeyev Popov determinant that this is just the determinant of the standard Laplace operator. So you can write it as C bar minus the Laplacian times C. So now I have HV section where I have introduced both the electromagnetic field and the ghost field. Okay, so this is the total action in this. Okay. And of course, the ghosts, we can treat them, but they are not coupled to the photon. Yes, the ghosts are not decoupled from the photon. Here, the gauge field is a photon. And this will stay true if you couple the gauge field to a Dirac field, like in QED. So no need to ghost in QED. However, let's consider this very simple thing. They are still there. So there should be some BRST symmetry. What is the BRST symmetry? Well, it's written there. Basically, the BRST symmetry is, did I wrote it? I wrote it somewhere. Yes, I have some. So what is the BRST in this case? Well, remember, Q acting on the gauge field transform it into the covariant derivative of the ghost field C. Here, the covariant derivative is the ordinary derivative. There is no commutator. So Q of mu is just d mu C. You transform a boson into a fermion. Okay. D Q of C, usually it's a commutator of two C's. Here, no commutator, so it's zero. Q of C bar. In the original formulation, this is a Lagrange multiplier, the B mu field. But in the psi gauge, in fact, this amounts to take B equal D mu A mu. You see. So D mu C is D mu A mu. D mu C bar is D mu A mu. So you transform an anti-ghost into a boson. And that's it. Okay. So there is a BRST symmetry. And you can check that this action is BRST symmetric. Both Q of d mu a mu is zero, and Q of C bar minus Laplacian C is zero. So the total sum is, what you can check is that Q of this term, this Lagrange density, Q of this Lagrange density is zero because there is a cancellation between this and this. This is a gauge fixed action. It's not the pure action. So it's not invariant anymore. But this plus this is zero. That's a simple exercise. Do that. Okay. So there is a BRST symmetry in Maxwell theory. Now, what does this mean in canonical quantization? Well, in canonical quantization, we have free fields, so we can use the standard procedure. We you start from a vacuum, you have creation and annihilation operator for the modes, both for the gauge field, that's what you have studied in QFT1, but also for the C's and C bar. You see. So, for the C's and C bar, of course, you know that. And both fields are massless. You see. So all the fields are massless. Massless. So a one particle state which has some given four momenta, let's call it K0, or rather K0 and K, must satisfy the fact that K squared, that's on shell condition, which is that K squared equal with my notation, that's K0 squared plus K squared equals zero. It means just that the momenta are on the light cone, well, the momentum light cone, and therefore that K is of the form modulus of K. And of course, K is just the energy of a state. Okay, that's standard, mass less. Okay, and of course, for the gauge field, for the AMU, you have the polarization. Degrees of freedom. So the polarization, this means that if you consider a classical AMU, which is of the form AMU EIKX, if you consider AMU equal E, it has to be epsilon mu EIK times X for classical fields, those are. And epsilon mu, you have four possible epsilon mu. And if you go to a given momentum, a field with a momentum K, so you consider a space momentum K, you have four polarization. So let's write K equal, well, modulus of K times some unit vector. U is a 3 vector, E is energy, okay. You have the transverse polarization. Transverse polarization, epsilon times U equals 0, but well, let's say epsilon, the 4 vector is 0, some epsilon, space with epsilon times u equals zero. So they are the polarization is only in space and it's orthogonal to the space vector. That's the one we are used to in QED. Okay, you have the longitudinal modes. And you have the longitudinal modes, which are unphysical. So they are physical, we like them. Those ones are unphysical. And you have two longitudinal modes. You have the forward modes, epsilon f, where this is 1, 1, let's say, and 0, 0, well, 1 and u. And the backward polarization, which is 1 minus u. This is forward, and this is backward polarization. That's the choice. So you have your right cone. Here I have a K. So the epsilon orthogonal. So these are the epsilon orthogonal. You have two of them. And this is the epsilon forward, and this is the epsilon backwards. Okay. But in this mode of quantization, all the four are there. Okay. So let's consider for simplicity just that we restrict our Hilbert space, so we choose a K. Okay. And we just look at the modes exactly. The one particle, the two particles, the three particles, etc., as states with this space momentum. After that, you just have to take the Fock products of the Hilbert space constructed for the different K. Okay, so that's enough. Choose a K and construct the Hilbert space. Hilbert space. Okay, so No, you know how to proceed. You have to associate to each state, to each mode, creation and annihilation operator. Okay, so you have creation operator for the orthogonal modes here, orthogonals, and you have two of them. And you have, so this is the annihilation operator, this is the creation operator, I equal to 1, 2, and I'm going to write the creation and the annihilation operator with a plus and a minus. Usually this is A, and this is A dagger, because the creation operator is a Hermitian conjugate of the annihilation operator, so this is just the usual A, and this is the usual A dagger. That's annihilation and creation operator. And they satisfy the usual commutation relation for creation and annihilation operation. And if you simplify by choosing a K, you have simply that the commutator of A minus is A plus. So if I have orthogonal I and orthogonal J, this is just delta IJ for the two polarization. That's the commutation relation used in quantizing QED in QFT1, okay? But you still have now creation and alienation operator. So this is for the transverse physical polarization. But you still have also creation and alienation operator for the forward polarization and creation and annihilation operator for the backward polarization. And since this is, well, these are creation of given states, and since the A mu, all those states are states of bosons, this should be one, this should be one, and the others, if you make a creation of an A with an A dagger B, etc., everything else commutes. That's the standard. Okay, so you have creation and annihilation operator for the physical polarization, for forwards modes, and for backwards polarization. Okay, now you have the ghost and anti-ghost field. So now you have the ghost and the anti-ghost. So they are at the level of the Lagrangian perfectly, you know, well-defined free field. They satisfy the same commutation relation, the same, you know, the same Machel condition, but they are fermions, like the Dirac field, except that they have no spin. Therefore, you have a creation and you have a creation and an annihilation operator for the ghost and for the anti-ghost. So this should be something like alpha and alpha c is a plus and a minus, but now they are fermions, so they should satisfy anti-commutation relation. They are fermions. That's Fermi-Dirac statistics. And that's a Bose-Einstein. Statistics for those one. Okay, and therefore you have alpha minus C bar times alpha minus plus C bar equal one. And the rest of it, the others, anti-commutator between those, or commutator between this and this, all zero. Okay, so you have a set of four bosons with standard bosonic commutation relation for creation and annihilation operator of bosons, and you have two fermions with a standard creation and annihilation anti-commutating relation for fermions. Okay, so that's quite simple. And out of that, you can create out of the vacuum. If you apply a creation operator for the vacuum, you create one particle states. So if you apply to the vacuum, apply on the vacuum, which has no particles, you get one particle state, and for one particle state, you can have Poulaccian state, transverse physical states. I note them too. You can create a one particle forward polarized photon. You can create a backward polarized photon. You can create a state with one ghost. I'm denoting the state obtained by applying alpha C plus to the vacuum. A state with one ghost and applying alpha C bar plus, I get a one anti-ghost states. So those are the six states of the one particle substates of the Fock space. Okay, so you get one particle states, and out of that, by the Fock construction for bosons and fermions, you get multi-particle states. Okay. And now you have a supersymmetry. You have a Q. You have the generator of the canonical quantization. So Q is going to transform the bosons into ghosts or antighosts. Okay. But before doing that, there is one last step we should do. I have defined creation and annihilation operator acting on the vacuum, but I have not specified in which Hilbert space all those operators live. So which Hilbert space? What is the Hilbert space? And of course, you could expect that this should not be an ordinary Hilbert space, because you know that those modes are, the forward and backward are unphysical. And the ghosts are unphysical because they are they are fermions with spin zero. So in fact, it turns out, if you do that carefully, that the Hilbert space is not an Hilbert space. It's called an indefinite or pseudo Hilbert space. Indefinite Hilbert space, which means that there is a scalar product, but this scalar product is not positive definite. And if you work out what is the scalar product you should use, you find that of course the scalar products between two epsilon I transverse polarization is the usual one. It's delta IG. It's positive. So it's positive on this space. But for the forward and backward polarization, you have F equals zero, B backward equals zero, forward, but FB equal BF equal 1. So it's a scalar product, it's symmetric, we're happy, but it's not a positive Hilbert space, because you see that in the space of F and B's, this is a matrix. It's 0, 1, 1, 0, instead of here where it's just the standard 1, 0, 0, 1 matrix. So this is the matrix that defines the scalar products. And you can check that out of these scalar products, if you take a linear combination, so superposition of F plus or minus B, you can have states with, you can have states phi phi, which is positive, but you can have states psi psi, which are negative. So you have negative norm state, you have positive norm states, so this is a positive, negative, and you have the F and the B's. Which are zero, which are called null states. So if you want to think of them in terms of probabilities in quantum mechanics, you have positive probabilities, negative probabilities, and states which have zero probability. So that's where the non-unitarity of this theory appears. So we are dealing with a non-unitary theory. Okay, which was expected. So now, what happens for the B's and the C's? Well, that's exactly the same thing. You can check that the CC equals zero. I'm sorry, for the Gauss, the C bar equals zero, and the C, C bar equals C bar, C equals one. So, Hilbert space for the ghost is also an indefinite Hilbert space with the same matrix 0, 1, 1, 0. And you cannot escape this. This comes out from Lorentz invariance, and this comes out for Fermi statistics, for spin 0. Yes?
Can we see, for example, that F gives 0 and...
That?
How can I see, for example, that like two forward polarizations?
It comes if you want, if you start very precisely, then by writing the fields, decomposing classical fields, decomposing them in modes, computing the Poisson bracket between the modes, keeping Lorentz invariance at all steps, and then once you have classical creation and annihilation object, you quantize them. So you, classically, you have Poisson bracket, which is object defined out of the fields. Then you quantize by replacing Poisson bracket equals zero by commutator equal one. If you are careful, you end up with this. You have no choice. That's because of Lorentz invariance. Okay, that's because, in fact, when you consider a d mu a nu, d mu a nu, for instance, for the zero component, the matrix is minus one. That comes from the fact that the metric of Lorentz space is the Minkowski metric is minus one, 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 zero, zero. So this minus one is crucial. It comes from this minus one. Okay, so now, let me go there. So you can make canonical quantization of this theory, but if you want to keep it Lorentz invariant, the scalar product in the Hilbert space is not positive definite, both for the forward and backward states and for the ghosts. You cannot escape this. But now here comes what's Q. What is a Q? You have a Q operator. Well, first you have an Hamiltonian, of course. This is Lagrangian, so you can write an Hamiltonian, and the Hamiltonian is just the Hamiltonian. It's just the standard A orthogonal dagger, well, A minus A plus for I, A I minus a I plus, where I sum over the two possible polarization, 1, 2, sum over I equal 1, 2. So that's the standard Hamiltonian. Of course, you have a K. You have the Hamiltonian is the energy. Is the energy E times, so that's modulus of the vector, times this. Then, similarly, that's A forward, A plus forward, plus A backwards, A minus A plus backwards. And it turns out that it's also plus the creation operator for ghosts, alpha minus C, alpha plus C, plus alpha minus B, alpha plus B. So you have a sum of oscillators, four bosonic, four fermionics. And you can check what this scalar products, Q is Hermitian. Perfect. But now, so this is the H operator. Now what about BRST? I told you that this action has a BRS invariance. So the Hamiltonian, you know, the Hilbert space should have an operator corresponding to the BRST operator. So there is an operator Q, this is the Hamiltonian operator, which acts on the states. So Q has some, if you turn out that you know what is Q in functional integration, so you can write a principle, like you can write Q. And it turns out that Q is just the energy. Remember, Q acts on the field by taking derivative, and derivative makes a factor K. So there is a K factor, so that's the energy. And that's basically Q doesn't involve the physical states, the transverse polarization, as we should expect. But it involves the annihilation operator on the backward polarization times the creation operator for a boson plus the creation operator A plus for a forward polarization times the annihilation operator minus for a C bar field. So you see, the Q operation annihilates the C bar and creates a forward polarization. So it replaces a C bar by a gauge field. And similarly, it creates a C by annihilating a backward polarization. And with these rules, you can check that Q of B, so Q of the transverse polarization are zero, they are physical. But Q of a backwards polarization is a ghost. Q of a forward polarization is zero. Q of a C is zero, and Q of C bar is, well, there is an E, but that's E, and this is E times the forward polarization. Okay, so that's the definition of Q in terms of creation and annihilation operator. This is Q, of course, Q on the vacuum zero. So this is the definition of the BRST operator, the BRST charge. And this is its definition as acting on one particle states. Okay, and you can check very easily, either from this definition and the commutation relation, or from just the action on the one particle substate, that Q squared is zero. You see, apply Q to a B, transform a C, apply Q to a C, you get zero, and so on. So Q equals zero. And since it's true in terms of creation and annihilation operator, it's going to be true on the whole Hilbert space of containing multi-particle states. You don't have to repeat the proof subspace by subspace. Okay. So now you can understand easily why, for instance, F equals zero. That's because F, a forward state, is a Q of a C bar. You see? So now in my big Hilbert space, my big pseudo Hilbert space, I have a scalar product. You can say also there is a notion of self-adjointness. You can say that if you have some states and A, some operator acting on some state, you can define that this is the Q, the operator adjoint of the states times A. So this is the self-adjointness. And you can check that this self-adjointness, that's analogous in this pseudo-Hilbert space of the concept of Hermitian conjugate. Q star, both H is self-adjoint and Q is self-adjoint. That's an easy proof. But because of those commutation relations, between of the definition of the scalar product, there is something very different from ordinary Hilbert space. The annihilation operator, for instance, is not the conjugate of the creation operator. This interchange F and B and C and bar. Beware, warning. For instance, I think that if you consider the annihilation operator of a ghost, C minus or alpha C minus, if you take its compute its conjugate, it's not alpha C plus, it's alpha C bar plus. So this Hermitian conjugation interchange C and C bar, and in the same way, A of F minus conjugate is A B plus. So the conjugation interchange B and F and C and C bar. That's because the scalar product is not diagonal but anti-diagonal. Okay. And this is essential in order to prove Q squared. And this comes from the commutation relation between the and the definition. Okay. So now a property of that you can check on the particle states is that consider that you have two states. Let's call them A and B. Consider instead of B, of A, replace it into A prime equal A plus Q of something. Let's call it C, another state. And replace B into B prime equal B plus Q of D. Okay. Then if you want to compute what is the, you can compute the scalar products of A prime with B prime. And let's assume that The A and B are A and B, the states in H, satisfies Q of A equals 0 and Q of B equals 0. Remember, Q is a generator of this BST symmetry, and we have seen that the action of the model is invariant. And the action of the model, or the gauge fix, is invariant under BST transformation because it's gauge invariant. And physical states have to be gauge invariant. So the states such that, which are annihilated by the operator Q, are called physical states. Which means they correspond to gauge invariant states. You see. And you can check simply because of Q equals zero means that if Q of A and Q of B is zero, any, then A prime B prime equal A B for any C and D, whatever, for any C and D. So it means that the, remember, we are in a scalar product, so the scalar product still has the interpretation in terms of quantum amplitudes between the states A and B, so those are quantum probability amplitudes, and it means that if you take two states, this is A, of course, and this is B. If you states, two states which differ by a Q of something, their probability amplitudes are the same. So which means that A and A and A prime are physically indistinguishable. You need for that that Q of A is zero and that A prime is A plus Q of something. You see. So it doesn't mind, it's not important. So it means that many of the field in your Hilbert space are just describe the same physics. And in fact, this can be formulated mathematically by the fact that you have a big Hilbert space, H, which is a set of vectors, phi, let's say. So it can be vacuum, one particle states, two particle states, three particle states, okay? Among those states, you have the states which are annihilated by Q. In mathematics, if you have an operator acting on a vector space, the sets of vectors which are annihilated by Q is called the kernel. So you have the kernel of Q. The kernel of Q is the sets of states such that Q of psi equals zero. Okay? And so states in the kernel of Q, which are physical states, are indistinguishable if you add to them Q of something. So the states which are Q of something in mathematical is just the image of Q. So it's a substate, it's a subvector states of Hilbert space, phi, such that phi, well, this is a phi, can be written as Q of some other thing. So the kernel is a set of vectors which are annihilated by the operator, and the image is a set which are image. Okay. And, well, there is a famous theorem which says that the dimension of the kernel plus the dimension of the image is equal to the dimension of the vector space. If we have. But the fact that Q squared equals zero means something very simple. Q squared equals 0 means that if you apply Q to a state in the image of Q, it gives 0. So it belongs to the kernel. So Q equals 0 is equivalent to state that the image of Q is contained in the kernel of Q. Okay, so now the fact that physical states which differ by an element in the image are physically indistinguishable means that in fact the Hilbert space of physical states, the Hilbert space of states which are annotated by Q and whose amplitudes are the same if they differ by a Q of something, is just what mathematicians call the quotient of two Hilbert spaces. You have an Hilbert space which is the kernel of Q. You have a subspace of it, which is a subvector space, which is the image of Q. So then it means that in mathematics you can take K of Q and distinguish him by him of Q. Take the quotient. So this quotient of an Hilbert space of a subvector space by another contained in it is a set of physical states. And I've made the illustration of this in the case of this very simple theory. But this comes from the fact that Q squared equals 0. So if for an interacting theory, a non-abelian gauge theory, where Q is way more complicated, it mixes particle states in different states. This is still valid. You have an operator acting on the Hilbert space of your theory if you perform first quantization with interaction. You have a subspace which is a subspace of states annihilated by the BRST operator. You have a subspace which is a subset of states which has the Q of another states. We know from Q squared equals 0 that in Q is contained in carrier Q. We can take okay. And let's see what this means in our case. In our case, for the one particle states, we had, it's written there. So the vacuum is physical. Let me take your color. I don't have green, so I'm going to take blue. So orthogonal states are physical. So they are in the kernel. Forward polarization are physical. The charge with one Q is physical. Those one are not physical. B. Okay. So, you mean it means that B and C, I'm sorry, B and C bar are unphysical. They are not annihilated by Q. They are not gauge invariant. And orthogonal polarization are physical. It's physical. But also, you can say that forward polarization and C are annihilated by Q. But they are in the kernel of Q. So they have no physical meaning. Any probabilities involving some F is zero. So this is a mathematical formulation that the fact that in an interacting theory, like in QED with fermions, of something which says that if you consider any transition amplitudes, S matrix element, with a photon, an on-shell photon with a forward polarization, this is the same that if you didn't have the formal polarization. So this means that this is zero on shell. So this comes from calculation in perturbation theory. This comes from something which is called the Ward identities. And this is the formulation of these identities in the BRST formalism. So you see that it can be very useful. Okay, so let me stop that. Of course, you can, a good game exercise is go to the two particle states using the formula. There are, I think, 10 of them. No, not 10, 11. Because you have, you can have a mixture of orthogonal polarization, B, phi, and C, C bar. Yep. And look at what is the kernel of Q in the space of two particle states, what is the image of Q, and check that the physical states for two particle states recover just states with two orthogonal polarization. All the other ones disappear. Okay, so that's the end of my discussion of BRST. I hope I've given you a bit of more intuition of what it means. Okay, so let's start after 10 minutes. And after 10 minutes, I will start. I'm going back. I will go back to the boson, to the scalar field, but start to discuss where do short distance divergence, ultraviolet divergence come from. So I'll start to discuss renormalization at a very low level just by discussing where and why there are some high energy, high momentum, or small distance divergence in the quantum field theory in a generic way. Yeah. Okay, thank you. Yes?
Sorry, I didn't understand how you related the Hilbert space of physical states to
Pardon?
I didn't understand how you related the Hilbert space of the physical states to the kernel of Q, and then you concluded that F and C and
well,
physical.
It turns out from this formalism that the only state physical must are the states which must be invariant under the action, well, which must be annihilated by Q.
Oh.
Because Q is a translation of, in the gauge fixed formalism, of gauge transformation.
That's exactly.
So you see, if you consider the state of we have one photons or two photons or one electrons, you cannot say, okay, let me perform a local gauge transformation, and it's going to another state. Physically, you have no way to implement physically a gauge transformation. Gauge transformation is just the fact that you have redundant degrees of freedom in the construction of your theory, but they should come out of the physics. So the physical results, the structure of the Hilbert space in a quantum system, should not depend on the way you have gauge fixed.
Yes.
It's just that. It's gauge invariance. Q, the fact that Q of A is zero, namely that physical states must be annihilated by Q, it's just a consequence of gauge invariance. It's just a reformulation of gauge invariance.
Why do I need to quotient out the image, though?
Pardon?
Why do I have to quotient out the image of Q?
That's because physically, imagine that you want to compute a scattering matrix between an in state and an out state. Okay, properly defined, the S matrix transition is just in, out. Okay. So imagine that you may ask, if in replace in, replace, so in is physical, so I take Q of in, it satisfies Q of in equals zero. If not, it contains, for instance, here, it contains backward polarization states and it contains anti-ghosts. Okay. And assume that Q of out, well, let me say, Q of in is equal to zero. Mm-hmm. Okay. So first, if you replace in by in prime equal in times plus some Q of something. You see? And assume that you are interested in outsets which are physical, then you can consider that from this formula, you can check that in prime out is equal to in out, whatever the Q star of it.
Yeah. Okay.
So, physically, this means that you cannot imagine a scattering experiment which distinguish in for in prime.
Yeah.
So this means that, if you think about what quantum mechanics means, quantum physics means, states are defined from the matrix element. So it means that physically, in equal in prime. Now, mathematically, in these constructions, there are different elements of an Hilbert space, but it's not a real Hilbert space, it's a pseudo Hilbert space, in equal in prime. And moreover, if you consider the subset, the vector space defined by the kernel of Q constructed by M of Q, you can show very easily that this H physical is embodied with a consistent scalar product. You see, just defined by that. If you take some physical states in and out, if you change in into in prime and out by out prime, that's the same results. So it means that this Hilbert space is embodied by a physical, it's embodied by a physical scalar product. Okay. And you can check on this example, for if you start from a theory which is unitary, you can check that this scalar product on H physical, that this scalar product is definite positive. So out of it, you define probabilities. So it is H physical, which is a proper physical Hilbert space. If you forget quotienting by M of Q, you have null states. Null states are states whose all the probability amplitude you can construct out of the null state are zero. So they are not observable, and therefore you can quotient these states, which is the kernel of Q, by M of Q, and then you get a scalar product which is well defined. K of Q has a scalar product, but it has null states. You remove the null states by quotienting by M of Q. Okay. That's a bit formal, but if you look in terms of just, for instance, the one particle states, but can do that for the two particle states, I did that, etc. You can go on. It's going to be general. Okay? You see?
Yeah, okay, that's cool.
So that's how this more abstract construction, makes sense in the level of Hilbert space, operator formalism, and in fact allows to, that's one way to derive the identities deriving from gauge series, deriving from gauge invariance, and to show why in particular you don't observe forward polarization or backward polarization in experiment.
Okay.
Okay. Yes?
Does Q squared hold also of shell, or is it an on shell statement?
No. I'm sorry. In term, you know, in term of in the canonical formalism, you construct only on shell states. The asymptotic states are, by definition, on shell. So the Hilbert space, you cannot, in the canonical formalism, speak about what are identities of shell. I don't think so. Well, maybe Dan is on. But in the functional integral formalism, that's the difference. There is no concept of on and off mass shell. You construct operator and matrix element between operators. And you can check that all the matrix elements you are constructing describes on-shell states.
If I look, for example, at Q squared on C bar, I'm getting like a box on the C.
No. No, because that's because of the equation of motion.
Yes. So.
Yeah. So Q squared equals zero, you use the equation of motion. Yes. But, the equation of motion are satisfied in the functional integral formalism. If you write something which is just the equation of motion at some point x, and you compute it with any operator on the other operators, so it's at phi 0, phi of x1, phi of xn. This is always 0, provided that x0 is different from x1, x2, x3. And that's called the Schwinger-Dyson equations. You see? So the fact that Q squared equals zero means that if you add the Q squared of something in any correlation function, you get zero. So this means that the operator here, considered as an operator acting on your Hilbert space, is zero. You see? Okay. Okay, so now, enough of formalism for gauge theories. We'll go back to gauge theories and a bit of its physics when discussing renormalization. So, I'm going back to the first part of my lecture, when I'll consider the free scalar field. So it's not a theory which is not unitary. I consider the free scalar field described by a field phi of x. Okay, the Hamiltonian is dx 1/2 of d nu phi squared plus m squared over 2 phi squared. Well, I don't specify whether I'm Euclidean or Minkowski space, whose equation of motion, classical equation of motion of minus Laplacian plus m squared of phi equals 0. That's a classical Klein-Gordon equation. Okay, and if we are just in the free field theory, the only non-trivial matrix element is the vacuum expectation value between two field operators. So the only non-trivial matrix element is phi of x1, phi of x2, which is a matrix element of the inverse of this operator. So let's call it g0 of x1, x2 by matrix, by invariance, it's a function of x1 minus x2 by translation invariance, and it's a solution of minus delta plus m squared with respect to x of g0 of x equal delta of x, where delta is a delta function in d dimension. And therefore, this is the g0 of x equal integral dd of k divided by 2 pi to the WD e I k times x over k squared plus m squared in the Euclidean spacetime, the n spacetime, and you know that if you do a Vic transformation, a Vic rotation to Minkowski spacetime, this becomes the Feynman propagator, which is integral dd of x divided by 2 pi to the power d. Well, I'm mixing the small d and d, but d is a dimension of spacetime, so Minkowski, I'm considering m of 1 time and d minus 1 dimension in spacetime. And this is, well, with my notation, if I write that the momentum k, if I write that x is t vectors and k is omega k, this is an energy, this is a comica, this is dd, so this is d of omega, dd minus 1 of k, the vector, and that's I over omega squared minus k squared minus m squared plus I epsilon plus, that's a Feynman prescription, and E I omega t plus k x. That's what is my notes. That's a Feynman propagator. Propagator, that's the Euclidean propagator. Feynman propagator, and if you are worried by the fact that I here have an omega t plus kx and not a minus omega t plus kx, that's because I'm considering here kx mu as a vector and k mu as a covector. If you go from k mu with lower indices to k mu with upper indices, you get minus omega k. Because I'm working in the metric here, minus, plus, plus, plus. While here I'm working in plus, 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 plus. So everything is consistent. Okay, so that's something that we have seen in the first part of this lecture. And now we haven't discussed, you have discussed in QFT1 the structure of this object. So now we start to discuss what is this object, what are its properties. So the propagator may suffer from two problems. It may, because these integrals may not be convergent. This integral may not be convergent either at large k, h4 momentum. These are called ultraviolet problems. you travel a domain, and at small k, which is an infrared domain. But large k means is equivalent to going small x, and infrared means small key, large distance. Okay, so let me first discuss this regime, ultraviolet domain. Okay. Well, first, when you look at this object in Euclidean space, this is a perfectly well-defined function, and its only possible singularity is when x equals zero, because when x equals zero, this becomes an integral over a four-dimensional k divided by k squared. So in the Euclidean domain, g Euclidean of x. Well, a simple dimensional argument, you can compute the coefficient in front, it's done in the lecture notes. It should behave, so you have an integral which behaves like k power d times k squared. So it has a dimension of a momentum to the power d minus 1. So, just by dimensional argument, it should be left like x to the power, so instead of d minus 1, 2 minus d, with some coefficient. Will depend on D. Okay. And this independently of the value of the mass, because it comes from what's happened when K is very large. So you see that in the Euclidean, it has a singularity at x equals zero. It has a singularity when x goes to zero. Of course, if the dimension my dimension of space-time is larger than 2, so in 3, 4. In two dimensions, you say, oh, it's a constant. But if you are careful and work out, you'll find that it's a log of x. So there is still a divergence, and the dimension is 2. And the coefficient, I think, is minus 1 over 2 pi or something like that. Okay. So, the propagator has what's called an ultraviolet singularity. And that's different from quantum mechanics. In quantum mechanics, if you compute time correlated function, they are regular at t equals zero. That's not equivalent. That's very different from quantum mechanics. Because in quantum mechanics, the analog maybe that's maybe that's dangerous to work on the last slides. So let me forget this. Let me erase this. In quantum mechanics, the analog of a two-point function, you can take for operator the position operator, and there is only one dimension of space-time, which is time. So the analog is vacuum expectation value of q of t1, q of t2, time order expectation value of products of position operator, and you can, it's an exercise, and you can compute that behave basically like a constant 1 say I have a behavior like that as a function of t1 minus t2. They are finite at zero. There is a discontinuity in the derivative, but they are finite. So this is a specific feature of quantum field theory. Okay. And it comes, of course, from the fact that the propagator behaves at large momenta as 1 over p squared, or 1 over k squared. So it's a universal feature. Okay. So this is for quantum mechanics. Okay. So I made the argument for the Euclidean quantum field theory. So in some sense, if I represent in Euclidean quantum field theory my space-time as just a plane in two dimensions, it means that the propagator has a singularity at the origin. And that's an ultraviolet singularity. Okay? That's Euclidean. In Minkowski, in space-time, you know that the Feynman propagator in position space has a more complicated structure because, of course, Minkowski space-time has a Minkowski metric, so as a function of x and time. Causality means that something should be different in the space-like domain, in the future, and in the past domain. And it means that the propagator has causal singularities on the light cone. It means that here the propagator is real in the space-time domain, and here it has some imaginary part, is different from zero. And that's required by causality. Okay. But nevertheless, so there are singularities, but there are causal singularities. So it means that they are not dangerous for the physics, but not only they are not dangerous, but they save causality. Okay. But nevertheless, you still have here an ultraviolet singularity at the origin, not on the light cone, but just at the origin, at coinciding points and coinciding times, which is, of course, just the Minkowski version of this. And that's for a very simple reason. That's because if you are interested in computing the Feynman propagator by points which are separated in the real region, the line element x squared is positive, like in the Minkowskian propagator, and since you obtain it by Vick rotation, it's the same. So in this domain, G Euclidean equals G Feynman. It's given by the same formula. It's in the future and the past cone that the Feynman propagator is given by the analytic continuation in the complex domain of the Euclidean propagator. So, of course, this means that from this simple argument, the singularity here has to be the same. Okay. So, and this is something which is really universal, because if you think about theory with more interaction, you still have as a building element the Feynman propagator. So there will be singularities at short distance in more general quantum field theory. And of course, these singularities are also present in gauge theories. Because remember, in gauge theories, the propagator for the gauge field contains spin indices, but for QED, for instance, in Maxwell, the propagator AA behaves also as x to the power 2 minus d. And for Dirac, well, the propagator is 1 over d slash, so it's not a 2 here, but it's x to the power 1 minus d. Yes. And but this reflects, you could say, oh, but in one dimension it's problematic. But not really, because for one-dimensional fermions, since they are fermions, the propagator has a discontinuity. Zero time, because of anticommutation. That's a propagator for fermions in 1D. So there is a singularity. It's a discontinuity which comes from Fermi-Dirac statistics, but it's not a divergence. While here, you have a divergence. Indeed, larger or equal to 2. Okay. So, let me say a word on something which is very important for gauge theories, which is that are there some singularities coming from small momenta? Well, for the massive field, no. But if the mass is zero, this integral may also diverge at small momenta. So, for massless theory, m equals zero, you have infrared singularities, which comes out from the small k behavior of the propagator. Because then the propagator in momentum space is 1 over k squared, which is singular, and not 1 over k squared plus m squared, which behaves like m equal 2. Okay. And for the Gaussian field, in fact, this singularity occurs. It occurs if the dimension of space-time is less or equal to 2. So they are not dangerous in 3, in 4 dimensions, because the integral behaves well, is well behaved like k equals 0. But they are important in 2 dimensions. In fact, in 2 dimensions, in 2D, I said that there was a log of x. But in fact, the propagator at small distance, well, at large distance, should behave like a log of x divided by something, well, times something which has to be a scale, because the log. And in fact, at large momenta, the propagator g of x, so if x is large, it behaves like, and I think it's a minus 1 over 2 pi or something like that, log of x times m. that the only dimensionless combination you can make out of the two parameters of your theory, a theory with mass m with a distance x. You see, that's true when xm is large. That's true when x is much larger than 1 over m. So that m is compared to x very small. And you see that when m goes to 0, there is a divergence like log of m. So there is an infinite singularity. I won't discuss that here, but should keep in mind. So for now, for gauge theory, the propagator is infrared well defined, but since you are on mass shell, you have other problems, and the issue of infrared singularities and infrared divergence in gauge theory is a very important one that I'm going to skip completely in those lectures. But you'll meet this in the more advanced course on the standard model and other fields. Okay, but I want to mention that the issue of whether or not there are infrared singularities is important, both mathematically and for the physics. And finally, I wanted to show you some picture, but maybe I'll show them on Monday. Physically, I just say a word. Physically, where does this come from? Here it comes from a calculation. But if you think in terms of the functional integral, you may ask, you have an integral over d phi exponential I s of phi in Minkowski, or e minus s of phi in the Euclidean. And you may ask a question which has a mathematical sense in the Euclidean case. What are the typical, which are the typical configuration in the functional integral? Which are the configuration in the functional integrals which counts here? Which has an action which is not the minimal action, which is a classical trajectory, but nearby. Okay, so in one dimension, where we consider quantum mechanics, so phi is q, so as a function of time, classical trajectories are just smooth trajectory. And quantum trajectories are quantum fluctuations. So in fact, there are irregular configuration, but the mathematics of them are well known. In time, this corresponds to what is called the Brownian motion. And if you look at the literature of Brownian motions, you know, a Brownian motion, first it was studied by Mr. Brown, but then the mathematics are studying, I think, this, the movement of small, very small grain of pollen or whatever on a fluid. He saw there was thermal fluctuation. But Brownian motions are things which are rather irregular. Okay? And they are fractals. They are fractals, so they are nowhere derivative, but they are continuous. Okay? And in fact, mathematicians can show you that a Brownian motion has a fractal dimension of 2 in 2 dimensions. There is a 2 here. There is a 2 here. They are in fact related, but I won't have time to explain that. Okay. Anyway, in 2D, So now we have x1 and x2. And you may ask, what is a typical configuration of fields? I'll show you, but there are in the lecture notes some typical configuration made by a very simple, you know, computer simulation. You generate a typical sampling of the configuration. And now, instead of a Brownian motion, it's some kind of surface. Some kind of surface, very regular. And you get a surface which is very spiky. And much more spiky than the Brownian motion. Much more. And not only it has no derivative, but if you try to look at the correlation of the value of the function as two nearby points, the correlation becomes larger and larger, you appear. So the fact that you have this ultraviolet singularity is related to the, I don't know if it's an English word, the spikiness of the configuration in the functional integral. And you see the divergence is more and more important when the dimension increases. It means that the spikiness increases with the dimension of space time. Okay, so it's really something which is intrinsic to quantum field theory, and in the functional integral formalism, it's intrinsic to the typical configuration in the functional integral. So it's not some little problem that you can cure by some mathematical trick. It's a feature of quantum field theory to have those short distance singularities. Okay, so let me end, and I'll discuss what are the consequences of that and why we have to use the renormalization procedure when considering now interacting theory next week.